So, again, my name is Benjamin Stafford. I'm a PhD student at the Carlson School of Management.
I'm Naomi Golden, University of Minnesota.
Yep. And so today we are interviewing Arnie H. Carlson, the 37th governor of the state of Minnesota. An interview is being conducted here at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs in Minneapolis. So this, again, is part of an oral history project, just to refresh your memory. Mm-hmm. It's a partnership between the Center for Integrative Leadership here within the Humphrey School, Minnesota Council for Nonprofits, who helped fund some of this program, and the Minnesota Historical Society, hence Pat's involvement as well. And so the project kind of helps all their collective missions. So on the CIL side, they're very interested in interviewing governors that have dealt with a lot of complex problems. And that helps them understand what leadership means in these critical positions and to solve big problems. From the Historical Society standpoint, they're going to keep this on file and keep the oral histories going. They've got a huge library of those, as you may have seen. So this will be added to those. And, of course, prior to that, you'll be able to edit as you see fit, and we'll get you copies of the transcripts and all of that. So that's sort of the background. We hope to learn a lot from you again, just like last time. These are more of a conversational guide, more than structured questions. So we'll be able to, you know, have the same dynamic we had last time, where we learn a lot from you. That's kind of what we're looking for. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Any questions before we get
Fire
started?
Away.
Great.
So in terms of the order we'll go through today, just to give you a little preview, we'll go through some of your prior to coming to Minnesota, the transition here, some of your earlier life in government. And then probably dive a little bit deeper into some of the details that maybe we didn't get last time, and especially focusing on your time as governor, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
If you would, I was wondering if you might talk about your early life in the Bronx, growing up in New York.
In the Bronx. Well, looking back on it, I wouldn't trade that background for anything. I truly mean that, because I don't want to suggest it was unique, because it wasn't, but it was good to see the downside of life first and then see the upside later on, as opposed to the upside going down to the downside. But the second thing is, it does shape your views. It has an enormous impact. I think overall in history, the early years of anybody are significantly underweighted, because those are the memories that, for some reason, seem to stay with you, no matter how old you get. My recollection of the Bronx was, we were poor. Everybody around us was poor. There were certain episodes that brought out the fact that being poor is not just the lack of money. It's also the lack of access to power. And I don't mean power in the big sense, but in the small sense. You don't live next to doctors, lawyers, professors, etc. You don't live next to the professional class. You don't live next to those people that know how to work the system. You're basically there with a bunch of people who don't know how to work the system, largely, in this case, immigrants. And they're just struggling to make it. And I would have to say that I don't think any city in the history of mankind has done a better job of assimilating different types of people more successfully than New York City. And a large piece of that was focused in the Bronx. It was messy, it was cruel, but out of that came a certain sense of liberalness, if you will, that has lasted to this day. And so when you think of New York, you think of a place that truly was the melting pot for the United States. And you were forced into relationships with the Irish, the Italians, the Jews, ultimately Puerto Rican, black. And you just had to make something good out of it. And ultimately, I think they did. So I found it a very rich experience.
I think last time you mentioned a really great story about how your brother was very sick at one time.
Oh, the appendicitis episode.
Yes, yeah. That's such a great story. Would you mind?
Well, no, I can't recall exactly how old I was, but he couldn't have been more than 3-4 years old, so maybe I was 6 or 7. And the ambulance came, he had appendicitis, And he was taken to Fordham Hospital. Well, Fordham Hospital was a public hospital, and it was to be free. But we didn't know anything. And apparently when my mother met the doctor, he demanded a certain amount of money before he would operate. And, you know, she went downtown to the church and tried to beg, borrow, and blah, blah, blah. She couldn't find any money. And finally, about 5-6 o'clock, she came back to the hospital and still hadn't been operated, but his appendix had broken. And that meant now the poison was going through that body. And she told the doctor that if my son dies, you're going to die too. And she meant it. She absolutely meant it. But it segues, if you will, into today's debate on healthcare. How can any civilized society tell a youngster that we'd rather have the poison go through your body because you can't pay than provide you with the kind of assistance that we have the capacity to provide? There's something fundamentally wrong in that debate. But that has always had an impact on me because it just shows what happens when you don't have power. If we had power, my gosh, we'd have the darndest lawsuit there is, and I wouldn't be here. I'd be living in some mansion somewhere in southern France, probably.
But then we wouldn't have benefited from you as governor.
Well, who knows?
Do you want to talk a little bit about your early education? And
well, it was in the Bronx, and we moved around an awful lot. We were in Lower Manhattan, I remember that. We were in the Bronx most of the time. And I, for the life of me, can't understand why we were always moving. I thought we paid the rent, but who knows? Maybe we didn't. But in any event, I have no recollection as to the whys. And moving was hard because the only furniture we had, Papa had made a desk and a dining room table. I think those were the only two pieces of furniture we had, and we had to haul them in the subway. And, you know, hauling these things in the subway, you know, I look back on it and say, boy, was I a sucker. I remember an episode with my older brother. This was in Lower Manhattan down by the East River. There were rats in the apartment, and he would sit there with a little bow and arrow and shoot them. I don't know if I found it amusing or not. But that's just the way life was. But in the process, you know, you're shuffling from school to school, so you don't have any stability. But my overall recollection is that there really wasn't much education going on. You were basically in a rectangular classroom. Discipline was the name of the game. And I can't say that I recall anything from an academic perspective that was particularly exciting. I did like my music class. I learned Aida, and I've always loved Aida ever since. I thought that was one of those beautiful melodies or operas that had ever come along. But in any event, no, there just wasn't much. And it was hard on children. I mean, it truly was. Because if they're not succeeding, they start to have a low self-esteem.
So that changed for you when you moved to the your next step in education, correct?
Yeah, it was a radical change. No, I mean, if I were to describe myself at whatever it is, 8, 9, 10, it would be a person who had a very, very low sense of self-esteem. I stammered something awful. If I saw a girl, I turned purple. there was nobody more naive than me, and more frightened, if you will, of what life was about. My father thought that it would be a good idea to get children into various summer camps. He was in his church. He was head of the Boys Club. And he would take him out on weekends, you know, see the Statue of Liberty, because kids didn't get out of their neighborhoods. I mean, it's amazing how shut in you are. The Choate School sponsored one of those camps, and so my brother and I both went to it. It was kind of a scraggly camp when I look back on it, 4 old tents left from World War I, I think, with a little wood platform and some cots. And I don't know, there were probably 30. 30 of us that were there, and the counselors were all students at Chart, usually juniors and seniors, and one teacher, in this case Hubert Packard, was the head counselor. And they had a chef from the school who came and cooked. His name was Ernie. I mean, I'll never forget, he had a hunchback. And he cooked the, he introduced us to the blueberry pancake. Mm. I've never eaten better in my life. I mean,
talk about formative experience.
Oh, he was good. He was good. He was wonderful. So we loved the camp. And for whatever reason, I never quite understood how it all came about. But my brother was very, very bright. And there were several other campers that were also very, very bright. And somehow the counselor decided that there had to be a scholarship. Choate didn't have any scholarships. Schools didn't have in those days. Your scholarships were reserved for faculty, children, and curiously enough, for professors, you know, maybe at Harvard or Yale that had children, or some famous minister that had one. And that was about it. So putting together a scholarship was an unusual thing to do. And they did test the various ones out, and Stan won, which isn't a surprise. He had a frightfully, dangerously high IQ. And so he went to Choate. And from that point on, you know, that's obviously a focal point of life, but it's such a difference because now he's with all the very, very wealthy students of the world, and I mean the world, coming from down here, so it's a black white. And then they decided, for whatever reason, that I would be eligible for scholarship as well. I found out many, many years later that my scholarship was funded by Hubert Packard's brother, who founded Hewlett Packard. But I didn't know that at the time, and unfortunately, by the time I did find out, he was deceased. But going there was a remarkable experience. I may have told you that I set the all-time record for the lowest test scores in the history of the school. Flat zeros in grammar and algebra. And I thought when I finished the two tests that I'd be on the 6 o'clock train. Nobody came, but suffice it to say, they then posted, when I came back from dinner, your classes, and my name was still on there. And I was shocked. I was put in the dumbbell section, but at least I was in, hanging on by a very, very tiny thread. And I worked extremely hard, and was blessed with a housemaster, Vivian Barlow, that I dearly loved, and I didn't realize it, but he was always, throughout my 4 years at Choate, he was kind of my guardian angel, always making sure that I stayed within the narrow frame, if you will, of expectation. And Choate was very much into predestination, based very much on the English model of Eton. And if you did certain things as a freshman, it stood to reason that you would have that status, if you will, as a senior. And I remember, and I may have told this story, he called me up sometime in November, December, and at the end of the first semester, and wanted to have a talk. Well, usually when a master, that's what their teachers were called, masters, when a master wants to talk to you, it's usually not very good news. And so he was very southern, from Barlow, Kentucky, and very tall, and he taught piano, and had that soft, beautiful, melodious southern voice. And he talked about, when I make my rounds at night to check all the students in, I see that he's here, and he's here, and then I see this, nobody's here. I said, I wonder who that could be. And I'm shrinking down in my chair. And then he says, I go to the bathroom, and I see these two little feet sitting there. I said, I wonder whose two little feet those could be. Could those be the two little feet that belong in bed? And he keeps spinning this story of horror out. I said, oh, my God, he's going to throw me out the window or something. And his demeanor completely changed, and he said, tomorrow, and I get a bit emotional, tomorrow the grades are going to be posted, and you're very high, and you've been elected vice president of class, and you've also been the only freshman selected to the Choate News, which means you'll be the editor-in-chief or when you're a senior. And then he gave me a lecture on responsibility. And I've never forgotten that. And it's something that every person should have. Because all of a sudden, I look back and, you know, here's this stammering kid who's trying to adjust to a situation that's very foreign to him, not exactly blessed with a great deal of self-confidence, and all of a sudden, my God, you made it. And now you're expected to provide leadership to others. That's an awesome transformation. But it was a remarkable experience, and I loved it very, very much. And from that point on, it was a whole different approach to life. Literally day and night, no question about it. So you're not going to the ash heap. You've got some opportunities now, and all you have to do is fulfill them.
You could tell us a little bit about some of your early college years as well.
Well, I came to Williams. I had to have a scholarship, and I didn't have enough money to visit these various colleges. So the only colleges I saw was as a result of athletics. I had seen Yale, and Yale was the place I was going to go to because my brother went there. And then I realized, my God, it's in New Haven, which is a dump. why do I want to go back to the Bronx? So I was in panic. I didn't know what to do. And then in my junior year, I won it's called the Aurelian Award, which is basically a scholarship to Yale. And I really didn't want to go there. Then I figured, well, I'll be tempted to go to Harvard. And so I thought of Harvard as this pastoral campus way out where the cows are and green grass. And geez, I find out damn things in Cambridge, and Cambridge is part of Boston, really. And there's a subway right under Wigglesworth Hall. So, oh, my heavens, this is awful. So then I noticed a number of my friends were all going to this place called Williams. I had heard of it. I didn't know anything about it. And so I applied. So I applied to Yale, Harvard, not Princeton, Williams, and then Middlebury as a backup. And then Williams came through with a full scholarship. So since all my classmates were going there, I said, fine, I'll go there. And then my roommate, who was going to go to Princeton, got the Ting Scholarship at Williams, which is the best scholarship in the country, because that funds 4 years at Williams. And it funds everything, plus all graduate school.
Wow.
And so he was going to go on to medicine. So he had to turn Princeton down and take the Williams scholarship, and he went to Williams, and then on to Harvard Med. Williams was going through a very painful transition. It was the fall of 53. It still hadn't recovered from World War II. People, you know, think the war's over, and all of a sudden we're back to normal. No, you're not. It's a huge transition. And Williams decided to have some social changes. Unfortunately, it coincided with the year that we arrived. One is that you couldn't go into a fraternity in your freshman year. So the freshman class was segregated. So we had to stay unto ourselves, and sophomores, juniors, and seniors stayed unto themselves, and there was kind of an awkwardness. It's kind of like what you people are debating in your sex policy at the University of Minnesota. You know, it's very silly, and it's not workable, but you're all arguing about it. Well, it's the same thing with fraternities. Could you say good morning to a sophomore, or would that be a violation of the code? So the result was you, in fact, were segregated. And two, they hadn't finished the freshman quarters for meals. So we had to eat in the old Quonset huts, which were left over from World War II. So I had to rush from football practice, and it was damn cold up in Massachusetts. I didn't realize that. And you know, my fingers were always freezing. I'll never forget that. And then they had to run up and grab your meal at the Quonset hut, and I was a waiter, so I had to wait on tables. Coming from Choate, I mean, come on, I was in the lap of luxury, and all of a sudden, I'm basically a GI, getting my face put in the mud in football, and then having to go up and serve these dreadful meals that they had. So freshman year was not anybody's idea of a good experience at Williams. But the teaching was excellent, and obviously things got a lot better. If I were to be critical of Williams, I'm not sure that at that age it's good to be away in a small pastoral college for 4 years. I think 2 years is what you want. And then after 2 years, you're kind of a semi-adult. You'd like to be at a bigger place. So I kind of regretted not going to Harvard. I think that's a fair thing to say. But I would love to see a system, and the University of Minnesota should consider it too, where students at 17, 18, 19 go to a smaller facility, acclimate, if you will, to the academic challenge, and then come to junior, senior year on the main campus, and then they're incorporated as part of the graduate school, and I think you can do a lot more mixing between the two. The other thing I missed very much was Williams was a bit off the beaten track. So Harvard was attracting all these wonderful speakers. I remember trying to go down to the Goodkin Lectures. Adlai Stevenson was the prime speaker. But, you know, that's a 2.5-hour drive, and I did go down. But, my God, I mean, I remember when I was a visitor at Harvard years later, it was awesome. I mean, every single night they had a prime speaker. I mean, it was loaded with opportunities. But, no, I thought Williams was a wonderful place, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and everything worked out fine.
So how did you end up at the University of Minnesota after your time at Williams?
Well, that was a very childish decision. I made a slugload of childish decisions. No, I really did. As a kid, my father bought us the Encyclopedia Britannica Junior. I'll never forget that. And I read it from cover to cover because it was the only books we had. He asked me anything about the aardvark. I remember that, the aardvark. But part of that was also the atlas. And so I'd look on the atlas at who had the green space, and it was Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota. So I said, oh, I'm going to go out there. So I was in college. I decided I was going to go to either Minnesota, Michigan, or Wisconsin. So I applied to all three, and the first one to accept me was Minnesota. So I said, fine, I'm going to Minnesota. Nothing particularly dramatic.
So what was that transition like, being an East Coast person, being born and raised in the East Coast, and then coming to Minnesota?
I never got struck by the differences between the Midwest and the East, and I think that's kind of overblown, frankly. I think what was perplexing was Minneapolis at that time, 1957, the fall of 57, it looked like a cow town. I think its biggest building was the Fauché, which oddly enough was built by a Williams guy who was a crook. At least that's what I'm told.
Didn't it open the day of the crash, or like right about there,
something mucky happened. But in any event, it wasn't much of a town. I mean, come on, New York, Manhattan, and then you see this, you know, 6-story building, and that's our flaws. And then the awesome size of the University of Minnesota. I arrived the day early, and, you know, I had no place to stay, so they tucked me in with the football team. And that was joyous, because right on the cover of Sports Illustrated in 1957 was Bobby Cox, quarterback at the University of Minnesota, and we were the number one team in the country. So I said, oh, my God, am I in hog's heaven? This is it. And, well, we crashed, as it turned out that year. Mm-hmm. But suffice it to say, it's an awesome. I remember walking down by the medical complex, Wangenstein, and all the great names of medicine were there, and wow, this was marvelous. I hadn't put together that the Mayo Clinic was here. You know, when you're out east and you mention Rochester, you think of upstate New York. So I always thought the Mayo Clinic was in Rochester, New York. I can't think of why. And then I found out it was here. Oh, my heavens, what a wonderful place. But no, it was an awesome thing to come here, and I was fortunate. I got a job as counselor at the Chi Psi fraternity, and I loved it. And I thought those students were marvelous. I think at first there's a tendency to have kind of a snobbish attitude, which is, you know, gee, you know, all these students, you look over the grades and the papers and stuff, and you say, God, you know, a lot of these students don't belong in college. And they probably don't. And then you see others working their way through. And then it begins to dawn on you that, you know, these guys that are working so darn hard, to go from a substandard academic background to a standard to really fairly high, those are the ones that are ultimately going to win. That's what happened. That's exactly what happened. I think the schools like Williams, Yale, Harvard, etc., I think there's too much cocooning. I think there's too much arrogance in the sense of we've arrived. You know, I got in, and that's the huge accomplishment, as opposed to something slightly more challenging, which is what now that you're in and you've graduated, now what are you going to do with the rest of your life? Mm-hmm. It's not an accident. I'm still very active with that fraternity, and many of my best friends were all part of that group. But out of that group, Denny Sanford, who's now the billionaire that everybody knows about, he came out of that group. Lee Lynch was my roommate. He founded Carmichael Lynch Advertising, one of the most successful in the country. The other roommate was a doctor, Ray Eccles, who became a dentist. A good friend was Les Bolstead. He managed some of my campaigns, did very, very well as a financial advisor and financial manager. Malin Schneider went on to become our corporate VP of Hormel. I mean, these were all tremendous achievers. And basically creating their own way. Nothing was handed to them by their parents. They had to earn it. And one became a professor of history, another became, wait, we had two professors of history. Orly Taylor is now at Yale, retired. He's probably the country's lead expert on insects. I don't know why he fell in love with insects, but he did. And so anytime there's something on the African, remember the African bee? People would say, that was always Orly Taylor with his big beard coming down, talking about the African bee and what the bee can do. But I think with the University of Minnesota, and I love the graduate school, I just thought it was extremely well-organized, well-taught. I adored it. I just love going to class. I thought it was a very, very solid experience.
Excellent. But I wanted to transition over to, you know, where you started post-college and really into the early years of your political and public service career.
Yeah, those are all muddled.
Okay.
That's the best that can be said for them. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I was in grad school, and then I was asked if I would come on board the Humphrey campaign in 1959. He was making a bid for the presidency, and the first stop was going to be the Wisconsin primary. And they wanted me to write a book. My ability to write a book would be somewhere in the D-minus level. I don't know why anybody would expect me to write a book. I barely read the darn things. But in any event, I was very happy to. And so they wanted to focus on disarmament, which was a big, big concern inside the Democratic Party. The party at that time didn't know it, but they were on the verge of a huge split between those who came out of World War II and were hawks. The biggest hawk in the Democratic Party at that time was Scoop Jackson of Washington, and the other big hawk was John Kennedy. But by and large, those who came out of the military service of World War II tend to have a very hawkish approach. And then there was the other wing of the party, Eleanor Roosevelt, Hubert Humphrey, and a lot of others, that believed that the best way to handle the Soviet Union was to disarm. And I look back on it, and that would not have been a very wise path to choose. But in any event, and going through all the writings and speeches of Humphrey, I noticed that many of his paragraphs coincided with those written by Reinhold Niebuhr, who at that time I think was a theologian at Yale. And so I had to bring to the Humphrey campaign the reality that plagiarism wasn't going to look good on the campaign trail. And I was expecting them to, you know, really take me by the scruff of the neck and throw me out, because sometimes the messenger is the one you punish. Mm-hmm. And instead, Herb Waters was the one in charge, and he just laughed as if, you know, I think he knew. He just laughed and says, well, would you mind doing a little speech writing? So, oh, yeah, that's fine.
But it was not a particularly well-organized campaign. I mean, looking back on it, it all revolved around Humphrey and his ability to speak and his ability to assimilate, you know, various pieces of data and then put it out. The Kennedy thing was incredibly well-organized. And when you think back, I mean, for Humphrey to lose Wisconsin, you know, your neighboring state, to a guy from Massachusetts, it says a lot. But in any event, that's where I so-called cut my teeth, if you will, on politics, aside from, you know, being a very active Democrat on the Williams College campus. Then went out to San Francisco just on a lark. Loved it. Best job I ever had was a insurance adjuster of 3 solid years of absolute debauchery. Magnificent. Absolutely magnificent. San Francisco is a place you go to, I don't know, to never be heard of again. Because the lifestyle is so seductive. You can't be serious about being productive. You can't buy into all those hard values of success or climbing ladders, whatever it was. No, you kind of live for the moment. It was magnificent. And I had a job that required maybe 6 hours a week of actual work. So I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And then I realized I was becoming a bum. No, I shouldn't say that. That's not true. I was becoming a good San Francisco person. Then I was asked if I would manage a guy's campaign, a fellow named Roger Boas, who owned Boas Pontiac, I'll never forget that, quite well-to-do. And he wanted to run for what amounts to the city council. They didn't call them city councilmen in San Francisco. I think they were called supervisors. Yes, there was the board of supervisors. So I ran his campaign, really enjoyed it, and he got elected. And then he wanted me to go to work full-time for him. And that's when I decided, no, I've got to be productive. The only place I can be productive is back in Minnesota where you freeze. And you have no choice but to work. So I came back here and went to work for Control Data. At that time, it was a very embryonic company. And then decided to run for the city council. And then from there on in, the rest of it we all know.
So you began as a council member, and then you moved on to the House of Representatives. How might you describe some of those earlier years in Minnesota politics once you returned?
Well, I love being on the city council. I think it's a huge mistake when people circumvent local government in order to go to what they think is a higher post. We had no staff, and I would argue that's the best thing you can do for anybody. Staffs ultimately, I think, ruin the system. When you had 13 people, you had to make your own decisions about the budget. And I may have told the story of George Martins. He was a conservative Democrat from the 9th Ward. Wonderful, wonderful man. And I remember one day, you had to go, you know, back to the office to type your own letters. You didn't have a secretary. So I would type, you know, it was always potholes. People always had pothole problems in Minneapolis. That's true. I mean, they did.
It stayed consistent.
It's consistent, yeah. But in any event, I mean, the more complaints you get, the more votes you get, because the more, if you satisfy the complaint, they're with you for at least the next couple of years. So I thought that was a productive thing to do. But I remember coming out one night, roughly 9-ish, and I see this light on, and I go down there, and it's George Martins, and he's reading the darn budget. I said, oh, my God, nobody reads the budget. You know, it's about yay thick. And he's going through it page by page, and he's starting to tell me about all the various errors, the mistakes, and all the other things that are wrong in the budget. And then he comes across this one paragraph that basically said anybody who served in World War II had all their service years added with the reserve unit years, and that became part of the city pension. So if you served in the Navy, which in this case was written for this one assistant city coordinator, he wrote the paragraph, it was really written for him. So he served 4 years in the Navy, and then he spent the next 15 years, or whatever it is, in reserves, and now he was going to add it to his city service. George caught that. Bingo, that sucker went flying out of there. That's one of the reasons you see, particularly in Congress, so many bad provisions. It's because people don't read the bills. And what happens is, when a conference committee closes, somebody inserts some language, usually the chairman, that the committee may not like, and the next thing you know, it's law. And then you find out you voted for it. And that's why there's such a reluctance on the part of both political parties in Congress to visit all the tax laws. Why? Because of the giveaways. And how did those giveaways get in there? I mean, they weren't an act of province. They came from some human hand. But George was meticulous. But it taught me the value of knowing the budget and keeping the budget very, very close to you. So when I became governor, we literally, we had two areas that ran the budget. One was over in the finance department under John Gunyu, and he was just absolutely excellent, don't get me wrong. But the other wing was right in our office. And that allowed us to monitor it literally on a daily basis. And believe me, there's a lot of fluctuation. But I learned an awful lot from George Martin's. I remember one discussion, you know, these developers always come in and they promise you Hosanna. You know, God, let us put this building up. Oh, my God, it's going to flow with tax money and blah, 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 blah. And finally, somebody said, can you name me one instance in American history where a development led to a reduction in property taxes? End of that discussion. That sheer bull. But it's like so much bull. Repeat it long enough, and all of a sudden, yeah, it must be true. But it was absolutely excellent. It also turned out I was the first person in Minnesota to ever introduce legislation on the gays, gay rights. I bundled that with broad human rights, and boy, was that a battle. I mean, that was just awful. And I came from the 12th Ward, which wasn't exactly in support of any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But it was George Martins who finally came to my rescue and said, you're getting burned at the cross. Mm-hmm. Let me divide the two bills, and we'll get one through, and the other one we'll take care of. And he did. But the point being is that... Here, George, a Democrat, was helping a Republican. And then I found out later he was a big supporter of my own and ran for governor, and, well, he was just a wonderful person. But human relations crossed all partisan lines. Mm. But it's a wonderful experience. I loved it. Yeah.
You served 3 terms in the office of the state auditor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you think you learned from that position?
Fabulous job. I would say next to being an insurance adjuster, probably the best job I ever had. Because it was predictable. You know, you become governor and you say, oh my gosh, I'll be at the office at 8:00 and I'm going to do this, this, and this. And the next thing you know, oh my God, there's a forest fire up north and some Democrat senator just called you a communist left winger and you got to respond to that. And you can't control your day. State auditor, you can control your day. It was wonderful. Mm-hmm. And it allowed us I think we accomplished more as state auditor. Because we created uniform accounting across the board. So all, and then that allowed you, once you have uniform accounting, you've got uniform, you have the ability to measure the outcomes. And it was from that we created the fiscal stress program. I was always baffled by New York City. All of a sudden we went bankrupt. Oh really, what time was it? Was it 2:02 or 2:05? I mean, and you didn't see anything coming down the pike? You know, it's like the Greeks. Oh, all of a sudden we're going belly up. Oh, really? You didn't see it 5 years ago? Of course you did. And so we took trend lines and worked them out 5 years. So you could tell where you've been, where you are, and based on that, very likely where you're going. And two big problems that municipal government has in Minnesota. One is convincing the public that having a reserve fund is a virtue. Here in the United States, if you have 3 extra bucks, it's a cardinal sin. You got to spend it, and we are a spending society. We're not a good saving society. The second thing is maintenance. There's always a reluctance to engage in maintenance because it has so few political rewards. But the reality is, it has some very negative consequences if you don't maintain as you're going along. So if you own a home, you've got to put aside X number of dollars to make sure that your painting, your plumbing, your electrical, all of these things are working appropriately. But what I found was that municipal officers and county people, they really liked it. And they liked it for two reasons. One, politically, it's great to have the state auditor come in and talk about your finances and praise you. That's your page one story in your local newspaper. And it's kind of like the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. But the second part, which I hadn't expected, was it reinforced the hands of the chief financial officer who was trying to get his council or county board to understand why you set aside reserves, why you do ongoing maintenance, why you do some of the things that to you are routine but are frightfully important to avoid all sorts of negative consequences. So we had tremendous local support. I mean, it was awesome, and it crossed party lines. It had nothing. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And now the auditor's office is on the brink of being abolished, and part of the reason is they abolished that fiscal stress program. And so they never developed the relationships with the counties and the cities that they need. Nobody likes auditors coming in, I can tell you that. I mean, auditor is the most unwelcome guest you can have. But if that person can provide assistance to you, particularly you as a professional, that's great. So you get people like, for instance, the mayor of Duluth, who is stepping aside, but I understand he's a very prudent manager of finances. He would have found our program right up his alley. He would have loved it.
We're going to actually transition from across political lines to perhaps within and on either side of them. And wanted to talk a little bit about how the path to governor came about.
So you want to talk a little bit about the 1990?
Yeah, I hope you people will, and I think I do it almost as a separate project because, one, I only see one piece of it, and I think there are a lot of other people that would see it. But the other part of it is it was a unique experience in American history, and it is something. While the people are still alive, I would certainly try to get their viewpoints on, and I'll be happy to work with you on it. My recollection of it is kind of your recollection as well, which is we as a candidate and as a campaign, we ran a very, very good 1960s campaign. We won all the, there were a series of debates in those years that were sponsored, I can't remember by who, but, and we won them all. We won the endorsements of newspapers and we were riding high in the polls. But we didn't have any kind of a ground game. We had no get-out-the-vote phone call. We had no identification of who our support base was. And when primary night came, we really got clobbered. I mean, we got butchered. I think we carried one county, and that was the one that Joan L. Dierstedt was from. I want to say it's Goodhue. I think Goodhue County, which includes Rochester, voted for us. That was about it. So that was a smashing defeat, and God knows my ego was somewhere down by my toes. And Grunseth, in fairness to me, all he had to do was rally the gun people and the pro-life people, and they did, and bingo, they showed up. And our fair-weather friends obviously didn't, and they crushed us. Then we began hearing, then I had to go through the painful reality of my brother sat me down and said, you know, you've got to endorse Grunseth and blah, blah, blah. My wife and I weren't particularly inclined, but we decided, well, there is nothing else you can do. Your political career is over, which it was. And so we endorsed Grunseth, and then we went around to his various campaign headquarters, flew the state, and I was, they didn't have anything. I get beaten by this. I mean, it's like the University of Minnesota football team losing to Washburn High. I mean, God, how did they beat us? I couldn't believe it. They had nothing. It was sparse. It was a little telephone operation. Everything was out of Washington. I didn't know that. But then on the plane back, my brother was telling me some stories about there's going to be some negative news on John Grunseth appearing in the newspaper, and it's kind of a convoluted story about girls in a pool and little sex or whatever it was. And the Sunday paper came out,
It was quite a different story than Stuart Larson told me.
And it didn't make John Grunstead look very good. He was in deep, deep trouble. And so from that point on, there was a move. We did not create the move. For whatever reason, there was a public outcry of just sheer frustration. On one hand, they were tired of Perpich, who was constantly criticizing the divorce settlement and the child, support that Grunstedt was giving to his daughter or something. And what that had to do with the political issues of the time remains to be seen. And just a groundswell of people started to gather around the auditor's office and start to ask if, you know, ask or scream, whatever it is they do. If I would run, and then finally our people started to say, you know what, we could do a writing campaign. Behind that was people like Lars and Paul Anderson and Wheelock Whitney and George Pillsbury. There's a whole group of them, and they all got together and said, no, we can fund it. We can do it. Our biggest problem was, how do you spell Dierstedt? Gee whiz. Even I can't spell it now, right? I'm not sure. Well, that was a heck of a hurdle. How do we do that? Well, suffice it to say, I didn't worry about that. They just kept me going. And the more I went around the state, the bigger the crowds. You know, kind of like Bernie Sanders. They were just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it was crossing party lines. Volunteers would tell stories of going downtown, passing out literature, and coming back with dollars stuffed all over them. And people just come in and just contribute. I may have my facts wrong on this, but what I may be discussing came after we became an official candidate. Grunstedt was to pull out on a certain date, and then he did not. And he had Cal Ludeman in the wings. He was going to resign and suggest that the party nominate Cal Ludeman, which the party could do. And Ludeman then would have been the party nominee. But he decided that he's going to continue to run. So he did, and then several days later, the clock ran out. And I don't think he ever knew that. And when the clock runs out, that means that the person who came in second in the primary is automatically the party's candidate. So we were fortunate. They had no choice. And even with that, the party didn't want to endorse me. And by this time, Boschewitz was beginning to realize that this was having a terrible impact on his campaign. So he tried to, and successfully, I should say, appeal to the executive committee of the Republican Party and said, look, you may not want Arnie, but my gosh, you got to save me. So endorse him, please. And they did. I'm sure if it wasn't a joyful endorsement. But in any event, and then the crowds just, literally, I don't think I ever made a speech. I don't think I ever got more than several sentences out, and the cheers, and I mean, it was unbelievable. But I think for purposes of history, it's something you may want to interview a whole variety of people on, because it was a remarkable chapter. I mean, Jonelle Dierstedt was challenged legally as to whether or not she could be on the ballot because Grunstedt's running mate, I can't recall her name right now, maintained that she was still the party's lieutenant governor choice, and therefore she should be on the ballot. Hmm. And if Grunstedt stepped aside, she didn't. And so that became a court case. It was rushed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that no, Jonelle Dierstedt would be on the ballot. Well, the problem with that was Friday night, if I recall correctly. Ballots had already been printed. And that meant that all the absentee ballots had already gone out, and so it was kind of a muddled mess. And I remember election night at about 7 o'clock, we were having dinner at that hotel, and one of the national networks came over and said, we're going to call it for you. And obviously, we were delighted,
and 8 o'clock came and there was no call, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, no call. And we knew what it was the absentee ballots. And there's always a tendency in any campaign to exaggerate the number of absentee ballots that are out there. But
we figured there was no way in the world we could do well on the absentee ballot without the printing of Dierstedt's name. And then about 5 in the morning, we called Christensen, Marge Christensen, good person, good friend of ours. And she was in charge of the Hennepin County counting, and she said that, no, you're carrying the vote, the absentee vote in Hennepin County. And at that point, we knew we won. I mean, that's amazing.
It's a remarkable testament to you know, the public is always accused of being indifferent, but they were not indifferent. They were the activists. They were the leaders. And they were just fed up. And they wanted a change, and they got their change. And I've heard stories of people flying back from Miami to come back here and vote, and all sorts of stories of people that went way out of their way in order to cast a ballot in. It just tells me so much about what the democratic spirit is. No, the people have it. If you give them a chance. But it was just a remarkable event. I mean, I happen to be blessed because I was the benefactor of it all. But the reality was it was a remarkable experience, absolutely remarkable and absolutely unique, and I doubt that it will ever be duplicated again.
How did that stack up against the 94 race?
It was the exact opposite. I mean, first of all, I like John Barney. He's a very nice person, and oddly enough, we worked together. I don't think there was. I mean, first of all, the challenge that particular year was not with the Democratic Party, it was with the Republican Party. We knew that there was no way I could get endorsed. And so then the question becomes, well, how do you deal with it? Well, you got some options. You can ignore them, or you can go to them and say, I want your endorsement, knowing full well they're going to kick you in the rump. Or you can say that I would like to address you, and I know that you're not going to endorse me, but at least let's try to keep it civil. So we chose the last course. And so I came down to the St. Paul convention and went up on stage to a healthy round of booze. And then all these wonderful people stood up and turned their backs to me, and I talked to their backs, which I thought was quite amusing. I'm not sure I gave a particularly good speech. I'm not even sure what the heck I ever said. But in any event, it was polite. And then, yeah. But all the questions from the media kind of perplex me, and it really kind of bothers me. Because it was always about, gee, Arnie, how come you can't get along with your own party? You know, I gave the same speech on human rights that Hubert Humphrey did, except they celebrated Hubert Humphrey, but when I give it, oh, it's why can't you get along with your party? It was all on human rights. They were willing to overlook the abortion part, they were willing to overlook the social agenda, but to swallow gay rights, they couldn't do that. They could not do it. But it was interesting, the media attack was not thank you for going out in front on human rights, it was why can't you get along with your party? And there is a political prejudice, and I really hope that this institute will address it, and that is certain issues are owned by Democrats, and Republicans have no right to get into it. Environment and human rights being the two biggest. The truth is, the EPA was created by Richard Nixon, and the local EPA here was created by Harold Evander. And Theodore Roosevelt was a Republican. So they got a rich heritage in the environment. Now, admittedly, they're denying that heritage, but that's a separate issue. But the same thing on human rights. Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. And a lot of advancements in human rights came from Republicans. And that seems to be blurred. So when we made gains for the gay community, that's kind of blurred. And to me, that's a wrong. But we got butchered. I got booed off the stage at Forest Lake. I got booed off the stage in St. Cloud. I got booed off the stage here in St. Paul. And it was all because of that issue. I mean, we took a bath on that one. But the campaign itself just unfolded predictably. I mean, God, we just had the best team in the world. Joe Weber took the mechanical part. Every night I'd call him and say, how do the polls show? Oh, you're still at this level. And then all of a sudden you get a little bump. Oh, you're going up this one. So it was eminently predictable. And Cindy Bricado was on the PR side. And I'll tell you, there's nobody better than Cindy. Give her a couple of six guns and boy, oh boy, she'll decimate the opposition. She was magnificent. And then we had the wonderful foil of the Republican candidate. What was his name? Does anybody remember his name?
It wasn't Cal Ludeman that time.
No, no. I don't know. But he was the one who said women have a, what was it, predilection for the kitchen and the bedroom, and those were the two rooms they could visit, but they're not welcome elsewhere. I mean, Wow, was he a wonderful target. But we had the whole business community out campaigning for us. I mean, guys who had never made a political call in their life were all of a sudden making them. It was a marvelous campaign, absolutely marvelous. I can't think of anything that went wrong. It just unfolded with absolute perfection.
So moving back a little bit, do you want to describe a typical day in your first term as governor? And what do you remember the most about the atmosphere in the governor's office?
Yeah, I think the first year is a year you should spend some time on. Mm-hmm. People always like to brag about their successes, but the truth of the matter is success usually comes out of failure, and God knows I had enough failure the first year. We made about every mistake that you possibly could. Starting with the transition.
That wasn't entirely your fault, though.
Well, it was. I mean, ultimately, yes, it is your own fault. We knew that the state had a huge deficit, and we campaigned on that deficit. If anything, we understated the size of that deficit. But we also knew something else that never did become public, and that was the depth of it. That it reached well into that budget, well beyond what the public was aware of. So we went in really with eyes wide open. And then about a week after the election, it's announced, I think it started out at 1 point something billion, and it finally grew to about 2.3, but it was even worse than 2.3 because all the reserve funds had been depleted. And that was the ugly story that hadn't been told. At that point, being a person who thought he was a student of history, I should have immediately said that what we're going to do is the moment I take office, on that very same day, the session of the legislature will begin, in a special session. And I would ask each of the four caucuses to come in with some guidelines on how they're going to shrink the budget, or the deficit, I should say. That would have been the smart thing to do because they created the darn problem. I didn't. And therefore, they should be responsible for coming up with how to plan to clean up their mess. Instead, I come in as this beneficent, kind soul. Oh, it's my problem. I'll take care of it, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that was really smart. In the meantime, I've got, Purbidge hunkered down at the governor's residence, refusing to take any phone calls. He won't participate in any kind of transition. And Doug Johnson and Roger Moe and the boys are blasting me every hour on the hour. Well, he wanted the job. Now he's got it. That was a statement of great kindness. And then we were stuck because we put together what we thought were good managers, but the truth is these were managers that had managed outside the political system. So they weren't used to the rough and tumble of politics. So then I had to deal with these endless leaks. Your reporter calls up, you try to be truthful, you answer the questions. Well, little do you realize that son of a, you're just giving them a big story. And the story may not be very good for your boss. And more often than not, it wasn't. And then I had a staff that was an eclectic staff that came from other campaigns. I had people on my staff who couldn't stand my guts. So here they are working for me, and they don't even like me. They don't even like what I stand for. I mean, I
So we started off on the wrong foot. Let's just put it that way. And the result was our polling numbers just went down and down and down. I was somewhere in the mid-30s. I may have sunk a little lower. I don't know. But psychologically, it has an enormous impact on you. You don't want to leave the governor's residence. You don't want to be seen. You know, you're afraid somebody's going to lop your head off. So it was very, very tough. And then, as often happens, you have a catharsis. But we did do several things right. The first thing we did was work with John Gunyu on finance and say that whatever it is that we do is going to have a long-term impact that's favorable. Everything will be on the long term. No short-term fixes. Because that's what Al Quie did, and they all come back to haunt you. No, it's going to be focused on the long term. That was good. Two, there's going to be a healthy dose of reform. And that was very, very positive. And that went through all 8 years. And three, we were going to be up front. So we did make some conceptual promises that were our internal guidelines. But I remember it finally came down to, one, we had to change staff. We had to have a new chief of staff, but also a new staff. And we approached Connie Levi, just a wonderful woman. She was out of the legislature, but also had a very smart business background. And she made the whole evaluation. And I'll never forget when she came into my office, she started out with the sentence, "The problem with your staff is that when you make a decision, they think it's the start of negotiations." And boy, did heads lock. Mm-hmm. We cleaned house. Mm-hmm. Just cleaned house. And we brought in John Riley, who was very verbal and had a excellent mind for concepts. He conceptualized very, very well. And then Ed Stringer, who had just come back from Washington, but he was a wonderful find. He wanted to come into the administration. He had made his money and came in as a deputy. And then we brought in Kurt Johnson, who has long been with the Citizens League. I never knew his politics. To this day, I don't know his politics. But a wonderful policy wonk, excellent policy wonk. And now we started to build and then the one person I wanted more than anything else was Cindy Mercado. I just, as I said, you give her a couple of six guns and boy, things happen. And she was magnificent. I would say literally within 24 hours, they had totally seduced the media completely. She and John just went down there and talked and started to deliver. And things really moved fast. And then our first big fight was healthcare. The Democrats had put together, I think if I recall right, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think they had put together a single-payer system, but it left a deficit of $500 million. So on one hand, they were leaving me with a $2.3 billion deficit. Now they wanted to add another $500 million to it. And then they had the audacity to put in a paragraph that said I was compelled to come back next January with the revenue source to pay for it. Well, that would be a beauty. So basically, we're gonna elevate you up there, and once we get you into that proper hanging position, we're gonna get our shotguns out, and we're just gonna blast away until it's a totally limp body. So we vetoed it, and instantly thousands of people—I mean, thousands—I don't know where they came from—just came out of nowhere. We're all over the Capitol, call me every name in the book. But we had a lot of fun. We held our ground, and then we started to veto bills left and right. I had always wanted the Italian vote, so I figured Vito will do it. Vito Carlson, that way, there we go. And boy, did we veto. We had the line item veto, and man, oh man, did we veto.
Yeah. This actually is an interesting point. So some of your memoirs, and at least the press clippings from that era, especially your first year, they kind of hinted at a pretty complex relationship with legislators. With the legislature in particular.
No, it wasn't complicated at all. It was very simple. They were out to hang me. What's complicated about that?
Fair enough. But those relationships seem to change over time as well.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Let me first develop the last point.
Sure.
The purpose of the veto was to introduce discipline on the financial side. It's easy to spend. It's not easy to tax. And we wanted the legislature to know in no uncertain terms that when it comes to the budget, we're boss. And that sucker is going to be brought into balance. And ultimately, we agreed to a tax increase in order to provide that balance. But we did bring it into balance. But we also knew something else, and that is the moment there's economic growth, we are in Prosperitiesville. So we were not going to have any potential of any red ink coming down the pike, a la Tim Pawlenty. There's going to be no red ink coming down, only wonderful blue. So we knew exactly what we're doing on the fiscal side. As to the relationship with the legislature, I am not known for my patience. Matter of fact, some people have even had the audacity to suggest that I'm rather impatient. And so long, tedious, John Kerry-like negotiations with Iran would not exactly be up my alley. So I tried to, as much as I could, avoid having to sit down in painful negotiations with the legislature. And in order to do that, we basically gave control to staff. So when staff spoke for the governor's office, and that was clearly understood by everybody. Two, we put out notes. And those notes were ultimately criticized by the Star Tribune because we basically told everybody what we would veto. So if you were carrying a bill that had a provision in it that we didn't like, you were notified. But the result of that was you were then compelled to go to the Republicans and say, well, what would the governor accept in order to get your bill passed? The result was that built legislative cooperation. Now, the Democrats had a choice. They could get into a confrontation, but they knew they were going to face the veto. Well, then what ultimately do you get from it? So there was a bag load of grousing. Well, when a bag load of grousing occurs, where do you think it spills out to? Right down the hall is where the media boys hang out. So that's what the media is picking up. Oh, those Carlson people, they're difficult to work with. Well, what does that mean? It means he won't surrender. That's what it means. They had no problem hanging me. But gosh, if I resisted or kicked, oh my God, he's a tough one. No. We had to get the upper hand with the veto. And the veto was ultimately our instrument of discipline. Then we had to teach the legislature what is known as fiscal tails, that if you spin out a program today, it has a habit of getting bigger tomorrow. And therefore, in tomorrow's budget, you've got to have a X plus factor so that you can finance your wonderful programs. A lot of times, legislatures play games with themselves in order to have a false balance in their budgets. By that, I mean they'll spin out a program and fund it for 6 months. And then they'll carry the same number for the next 2 years, which is sheer nonsense. It's going to be a multiple of four in order to fund it without any inflationary increase or any growth in the cost of the budget. So we basically said to the legislature, anything that violates our fiscal standards is veto bait. So gradually they began to understand, and also, may I add to their credit, they began to appreciate having to do some longer-term planning. They began to like it. They thought that discipline was good. The real turn in the relationship between the legislature and us occurred probably in December of 1991, I think, yes. And that was on the health care bill. As I indicated before, Democrats have this belief that anything that deals with compassionate, they own. And God knows Republicans are all like Scrooge. You know, he's their model. And I had asked Marlene Marshall, who is the commissioner of health, and her deputy, Mary Jo O'Brien, if they would come back with a demo health bill. And then I laid out several guidelines for them. I was not into universal coverage. I wasn't going to fight that battle. I didn't think it was worth it because our numbers were already fairly low.
And the ones that don't want to go into the system, frankly, are students. But in any event, we wanted cost containment. We wanted the cost containment inside the package itself, pre-existing conditions, all various other things. And she came back in December, and I'll never forget the reception room where we were to hold the release of the report. It was packed with people, including a lot of Democrat critics. They were all ready to start, you know, another war. And her report was excellent. And that became the basis of what we now know as MinCare. And in fairness to the Democrats, they, from that point on, there was a new sobriety. That this is a governor, one we can work with. He does want health care. They didn't question that anymore. And all we have to do is iron out some wrinkles here, and we got a deal. And from that came the gang of, I think it was called 8, am I correct, or 7, whatever it was. And that was a bipartisan group of legislators that worked with us and ultimately gave us Minnesota Care, which I would argue was probably the best model in the country. I think it was. I think Obama would have been well advised to have adopted that one.
I wanted to take a quick step back to just close out one point on the veto thing, because this was a controversial part of especially the first term, at least, you know, and you spoke to some of the coverage of it. Like Roger Moe once said that leadership by veto is not leadership at all. There was a Supreme Court battle over some of the use of veto and the back and forth of that. And so that was debated both, you know, between the really all three branches. And I wanted to get your grasp on how that hashed out.
I'm not aware of any Supreme Court limitation on the veto. Was there one?
There were some court cases that went back and forth that actually ended up ruling in your favor.
Yeah. No, we had no problem with the veto at all. Roger's a good man. I like him. Always enjoyed working with him. But that doesn't mean he's not, you know, exaggerate. What the hell do you think the founding fathers put the veto in the bill for? It's a joke. I never understood why governors sat there and admired the veto and never used it. That's your most powerful instrument you have. Oh, we loved it. Absolutely adored it. I loved it before I was governor. And I was determined to use it. And by the way, if we hadn't used the veto, we never would have brought the budget in balance. It would have been an absolute impossibility. And what in the world are you negotiating? It's like negotiating with the Greeks. What are you going to negotiate? You got too much debt. You can't afford to pay the debt. It's a frightfully simple problem. Well, that's what these guys wanted. They wanted more debt. We said no. And by the way, to this day, I haven't met anybody who's missed the programs we eliminated. What people have to remember, and this is one of the drawbacks to government has a tendency to expand during times of prosperity. And you got to be very careful about that expansion, because no longer is that a priority item that's being expanded. It's a non-priority item. It's a peripheral item. It would be like a family all of a sudden getting 50 extra bucks. All right, well, we'll go to a couple of ball games or something. Well, that's not part of your normal budget, and it doesn't have a considerable amount of value when you, in the context of family needs. And all we did was scrape a lot of barnacles off the ship of state, and to this day, I'm not aware of any effort by the Democratic Party to bring those programs back.
So education was a huge part of your administration. What was it like to go after your education agenda, especially like the charter schools and the school voucher programs?
I'm not sure we did as much in the area of education as we should have. I wasn't the one who came up with school choice. I mean, that was an idea that's been kicked around for quite a number of years. A member of our staff, Sullivan was his last name. I can't think of his first name. My gosh, that's awful. I should remember it. Tim Sullivan, came into my office one day. Very, very bright fellow. Very serious young man. Just the kind of idealist that you want on staff. And he sat down and he said, you know,
your popularity is strong. You can ride off into the sunset, and you'll be regarded as a fine governor. But I want to lay out something for you that I think is of great importance. And you start to spell out school choice. And he made no bones about it that I was a benefactor of school choice, and so therefore I owed it, if you will, to do it. And I agreed. He was right, absolutely correct. The question becomes all the details involved. Because what do you mean by school choice? Are you going to fund students to go to Blake and Breck, et cetera? Are you talking about the parochial system, which is lower cost? How is it going to work, and how do you get rid of the constitutional lines, and then how do you deal with the teachers' union? But from that point on, you know, it's like any idea. You've all been through it. You think of it 24 hours a day, and you start to get new wrinkles and new insights, if you will. And said, yes, this is a battle worth having, and we are going to have it. And this is where growing up in the Bronx, I think, paid handsome dividends. The first reaction of the organized effort was, we'll raise money, we'll go onto the airwaves, we'll sell it to the broad public, and blah, blah, blah. And my attitude was, yes, you can do that, but I think we got to go into the community that's most likely to benefit, and we got to go into the Black community, we got to go into the Latino community, and we got to get them on board. And the attitude at that time was, no, it's impossible, it's not going to work, and, you know, they're Democrat and blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, we're going to make it work. And then I had a wonderful staff attorney. My God, what's her name? God, she was such an important part of our history. It will come to me. And her mother was from Cuba. So she had ins into the Latin community. And she was with me all the way. She said, no, we'll go in. And she arranged for me to go to Sister Guadalupe Church in St. Paul. And we got there on Sunday, and the priest welcomed us and introduced us. And I gave my talk, and then he gave a talk endorsing the idea. Oh, my gosh. Here we were in the heart of a Democrat district, but more importantly, it was the guy who ran for governor, and he had put out the statement that this bill will never pass except over my dead body. Well, that was his body that the priest was burying at that point. So they came out, and they liked it. They liked it. They really liked it. And they liked the idea of a governor coming down and talking with them and answering questions, et cetera. That just went... could not have gone better. And then we set out to get the Black community. So I invited them over to the governor's residence. We had this big, huge white tent that covered all the backyard, lots of tables and everything else. And started to give my talk on school choice and what it meant and the opportunities that it would create. And then one Black leader stood up and said, I've had enough of this. I'm walking out, and I want you all to walk with me. And he walked out alone. And at that point, we knew we had him. And so the Black Council endorsed it. The Latino Council, the Hispanic Council, I think it's called, endorsed it. And that just cracked the Democrat facade apart. And then I let it be known that I'm going to start running some ads on all those wonderful hypocrites in the legislature who are opposed to school choice, but they send their children to private schools. And I was also going to do it at the Star Tribune. Because they were anti. And word got out that I was starting with this guy down in Worthington, and he panicked. And next thing I know, we get calls that we'd like to meet. And I was worried at that time, because it was into August, I think, and I figured, oh, my gosh, football season's going to start pretty soon. K through 12 is going to say we can't get the football team together. And, oh, my, and who's at fault? Arnie. Oh, my gosh, they're going to... hang me. But fortunately, they blinked first. And I decided we'll have our negotiations at the governor's office, and we'll do it in the reception room. And I assembled two huge tables.
and had the Democrats on one table, and they were fully expecting that I would be the point person on my table. I wasn't. I decided to sit in the audience, and I let Dolores Fridge, who was in charge of human rights for the administration, handle it. Well, she was a large black woman, extremely articulate, and she had taught for some 24 years. So there was nobody better to bring the teacher's perspective into it. She just ate them alive. I've never seen... She just had them wilting. They didn't know what to do. And finally, Roger got up and walked over, and he's put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, "We got a deal." And we knew it was over. And school choice should, frankly, be the standard of the day. And I'm very critical of higher education. Higher education complains about the product they get. They complain about the amount of remedial education that has to take place because of the defectiveness of the K-12 system, but they do absolutely nothing, and I mean nothing, to reform K-12. They just wash their hands of it and pretend it's not a problem. It's a serious problem.
So what do you think the University of Minnesota's role is in all of
this? The University of Minnesota used to have a school here, a high school, an experimental high school of its own. I can't remember what it was called. And I was always impressed with those students. Those were some of the best students that came out. And I put money aside trying to entice higher education to do exactly the same thing. Nobody took us up on it. They don't want to touch it.
The university was a benefactor of some of the budgets in
Excuse me, Tanya Kosicki. That was the name of the attorney. Okay. Tanya Kosicki. I later made her a judge. Wonderful person. Okay.
And, well, to talk a little about the University of Minnesota as well, that was a big focus of some of the budgeting and politics of the time.
Yeah, no, well, first, I mean, I love the – everybody loves the university. I mean, it's got some barnacles. There's no question about it. Mm-hmm. And I'm picking at some of those right now, as you well know. But, no, it's a remarkable place. I think what I liked about it was, one, my experience here was exhilarating, to say the least. But two, the fact that it's open so that people of all income groups can come here and still have an opportunity to succeed. And I think the public university throughout the whole United States, I think they ultimately will overtake the Ivy League. And the reason is the type of student that they're attracting. They're attracting the young, ambitious, hardworking, the ones who are there to learn. There's no coddling. That's one of the things you can criticize. There's no coddling. There's no easy pathway to success. Everything is a bit of a challenge. Getting into the right courses is a challenge. Picking out the major is a right challenge. My God, just figuring out how you get from one building to the next is a challenge. I mean, everything is a bit of a challenge. But the result is it builds up a sense of resourcefulness in its students that I think ultimately leads to success. And it's not a surprise. When I came out of here in 1957, I think it's fair to say that virtually every company, certainly in the metro area, was headed by an Ivy Leaguer. Today, I'm not so sure you can find one. It's headed by the guy who, or woman, or man, whatever, who worked their way through. I think we're blessed, and I think we're blessed to have it in Minneapolis. I really do. I think that's a tremendous asset to the city and to the metro area. But having said that, I think it needs to upgrade its brand of leadership. I think the day is over when you can pick somebody who teaches a given subject and say, "You're now the president of the university." It's a large, complicated management structure. It's a large, complicated financial structure. It needs people who have had experience in managing large structures. When I was asked some years back, prior to the arrival of Kaler, for so-called input, I prepared several pages of notes on input and started out by discussing exactly what I'm discussing with you, and the necessity of getting somebody with that background, preferably a CEO, CFO, or some that kind of type, that can manage that kind of a system. And I was immediately, no, we've already decided it's a PhD. To me, that's narrow, and it's not. It doesn't build us to success. I think the best president that we had, certainly in my time here, was Mark Udock. And I think part of the reason was he was an attorney.
he came in with a pragmatic mind. And he understood, he made it his business to understand all the moving pieces inside the system. And he also understood very early on what he could change and what he couldn't change. Well, the couldn't leaves a lot to be desired. But what he did change, he changed very well. And I found him a complete delight to work with. Very pragmatic, very ongoing. He's just an excellent, excellent person. But no, I think funding the U, and you could have had more money. I mean, I may have told you a story about poor Mark Udoff having to go to the legislature every single day and say he can't make out a list of priorities, which of course he could. But as I told him, I said, the minute you submit a list of priorities, they'll cut that sucker in half and then you'll negotiate only the top half. So, tell him you can't make a list. Much to his credit, he never did. And they got everything.
So, kind of switching gears a little bit, programs of social well-being were prominent during your term as governor, such as healthcare and welfare reform. How do you view those achievements while you were in office?
Well, very favorably. The whole debate on welfare to me was frankly a bit childish. You're basically saying that poor people don't want to work. They don't want to work their way out of poverty. They just want to be gifted something, which is nonsense. People want to work. They want to be productive. We all, as human beings, measure ourselves in the context of what is our value. That's one of the problems with retired people. All of a sudden, you tell a person, you're retired. You have no value. Then we're surprised that they get Alzheimer's. No, people... All of our life in the American system, we place a value on ourselves, whatever the role may be. And you can't tell people on welfare that you're kind of subpar. And we still do that in the debate. How the Republican Party can come up with the abusive kind of language that it does is truly offensive. If you want to look at the parasites, look at all the tax loopholes. Look at Ziggy Wolf. He's the biggest parasite that we have in the history of the state of Minnesota. We should have a whole statue to him and say, here is our parasite that we willingly funded. That's your parasite. But my gosh, to have a four-year-old child and you say, we're going to give that child nourishment, we're going to give that child shelter, and we're going to give that child an access to an education, to me, that's the best thing you can do for that person. And it's the best thing you can do for yourself. I do not understand the debate. And when you look at the money, the very same farmers that we subsidize, we guarantee 80% of their income. 80% of their income. Go to Steve Swigum, for heaven's sakes. These are the same people that live on subsidies, and then they turn around and curse government. And then they say, oh, my God, food stamps. Well, we can't give out food stamps. Well, what do you mean? We just paid you this in order to grow that food. And now you're saying we don't have a right to give that food to somebody who can't afford to buy it? What's the debate about? Is somebody willing to look at a three-year-old child and say, I think you should starve to death? Well, then go to the room and have the guts to tell them. Or go to a child and say, you know what? You're not going to get any health care. You can die. And by the way, what religion preaches that? I'm being a little bit too blunt for my own good, but you get the point.
I wanted to ask a little bit about something you alluded to earlier, which was... some of the relationship with the media and some of your staff and how that worked. How would you characterize your relationship with the press? Because it seemed to shift a little bit throughout your terms.
I've always liked them. Mm-hmm. They've got a job to do. I've got a job to do. There'll be times when you're in conflict. So be it. But I have not known them to be arbitrary. I have not known them to be nasty, with the exception of some editorials in the Star Tribune. But I called them out on that. One of the biggest pieces of fun I had, wish I could remember where it was. I wish I could say the Humphrey Institute, but it was an auditorium someplace, and the managing editor was sitting in the room right next to Laurie Sturdivant. And I remember we had worked very hard to get the AAA bond rating. And they wrote the smallest story imaginable. I think if a dog took a leak on a tree, that was a bigger story than us getting the AAA bond rating back. And they were always, they couldn't write an editorial that was positive without sticking the sword in the side. You know the sidewinders or the, you know, you're really a nice looking guy, but, ooh, that hurt. And I can't recall any time that they ever wrote an editorial that was praiseworthy without the negatives. And now finally they were my audience. I just ripped McGuire, that was his name, McGuire. I ripped him apart. And it was such a joy. Such an absolute joy. Mm-hmm. And then they have a gossip columnist. Now think about it. These sober journalists that come over to the Humphrey Institute and come to the School of Journalism and preach these lofty ideals. And what do they practice? Having some sleazy non-journalist write gossip and publish that gossip and elevate rumor to the status of truth. What does it say about them? They're in the sleaze business. But when you point it out, they won't talk about it. Have you ever seen an article, one single article, on why we have CJ? One radio station, if I recall correctly, decided to do the same thing to McGuire that McGuire's gossip column was doing. And I can't remember what they did, but he sure didn't like it. No. I have no problem with Rough and Tumble, and I have no problem with being critical, because they feel perfectly free to sit down behind their typewriter and criticize the daylights out of me. What makes them think that they're immune from criticism? But by the way, I respect them. I also like them. Because they got a role to play, and when they play it well, I admire it. They are not playing a good role on that stadium. You haven't seen one single article that actually adds up what the public is paying for that stadium. Not one.
I just think one of the interesting things we found in our research was, especially in the 94 campaign, is when they were doing like candidate profiles, that there was they were painting you in some respects as standoffish but also achieving. And so that had to be an interesting experience to be dealing with the press with that.
When was the last time the media ever described anybody in positive terms? It's not in their makeup. No. You know, some people have charisma. That's a word I've always loved. Who has charisma? You know who has charisma? The person who just won the election. That person has charisma. Hillary Clinton will have plenty of charisma if she wins the presidency. And she'll get it all on election night. But the night before, Zappo on the charisma. They're always too tall, too short, too fat, too this, too that, whatever it may be. Let them do what they do. Doesn't bother me. And by the way, standoffish. If there's anything I'm not standoffish. I may be belligerent at times, but certainly not standoffish.
Sure. So you left the office of governor to your successors in a very organized fashion. What might have you have wished that your successors might have learned from your time in office?
Well, I think what happens all too often, not just in government but elsewhere as well, is that new management comes in and they manage yesterday's status quo. And that's what we're doing today. We're managing yesterday's status quo. We're not managing tomorrow. We're not even discussing tomorrow. As a matter of fact, we're not even curious about tomorrow. And in the process, I think we're dissipating assets that we're going to need for tomorrow. When you look down the pike, in my day it was healthcare coming down as the huge
cost that, that you're having trouble wrapping your hands around. Well, now it's education. And it's education on two parts. One is its value, which is very questionable. And it's something that everybody's going to have to participate in terms of what is the value. And two, when the value has been determined, then you get to the issue of affordability. And that brings you to cost effectiveness. Are we delivering a product in the most cost-effective fashion that we can? You're exactly right. No, we're not. But we don't want to discuss it. Why? Because it's one of those inconvenient truths. But ultimately, we will be forced to discuss it. The United States is going to have to radically change its K-12 system. Increasingly, it's recognized as one of the weakest in the industrialized world. There's no way you can compete globally when you have such an appallingly weak K-12 system. And both parties, the Republicans lack the courage, and the Democrats don't want to take on one of their unions. And so there's a quid pro quo. And the quid pro quo is we'll keep the status, and on July 4th we'll pretend it's really good. But the truth is it's not good. And that has to change. And then the value of higher ed. That's a debate that's been going on as long as I've been alive, and higher education has done a magnificent job of avoiding it. The time has come to plunge into it. There was a guy, and I recommend the article to you, it was probably something like the Atlantic Monthly, 1956, the president of the Smith College, wrote a wonderful article on why do we have four-year institutions? Is it to, you know, if it's for the purpose of teaching people critical thought, he said, I can do it in 2 years. So why the four-year? Well, it goes back to the 14th century, and God knows if it worked in the 14th century, it must be applicable today. And that's what it is. But now the Internet's coming in and radically changing everything, and I think it's Georgia Tech, I may be mistaken, that's putting the BA on the line now. Now, the moment a person comes out of Georgia Tech with an online BA degree, everything changes. Because when their graduates start to go into the business community, whatever community they enter, and they start to succeed, then the value of their degree goes up, and the value of the expensive degree declines.
One thing I want to capture, because I want to come back to this, we actually have some questions later that may facilitate sort of a current issues discussion, but in asking this question about your successors, it appears, at least implicitly, the way you handed the office off, like that your administration valued successive governance. And it's something that you didn't experience, perhaps, when at least from the descriptions of how Herb attained the office to you.
Right.
And I know you had to hand that to others. You know, we found that really interesting how different folks have in the governor position have handed that off.
Well, I personally think that there is a sacred duty involved. There is something about an election and a transition that I think is sacred. And it should be honored. And I think, in fairness to presidents, I think they've done overall a remarkable job on handling transitions. They've been extremely helpful to each other. And there's no reason why governors can't be the same. What we did is what should be expected of us to do. It's not our place to decide that the people are wrong. They selected Jesse Ventura. He's their governor. Good. We want him to succeed. That's what it should be about. And we're going to give him every opportunity, at least from day one, to be able to be brought up to speed.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So I want to switch gears here a little bit to talk about a more general topic, if we could, which is one of the focuses of our interview here, and that's leadership. So leadership means many things to many people. In thinking of your own experience, who might have you have pointed to as somebody you thought as a leader that maybe helped form what kind of qualities did those individuals have that helped form your leadership style or influenced you?
I would say the first person would have been Ferrello LaGuardia, mayor of New York, which is curious because he spoke over the radio, but we didn't have a radio. So I don't know why I kept identifying with him. That's true. Kind of a folk hero, I think. I'm not sure. I mean, but I got the impression that he was using his office for the well-being of others. You got to remember, this was all the 1930s. These are hard years for everybody.
And he was this short, I think he was probably 5 foot two, and he's probably about 5 foot two wide, too. Quite a character. No, I would say him. But then, you know, those people that you respect and admire, that all changes as you go through life. I mean, I remember Woodrow Wilson. I loved his sense of idealism. And the way history was taught was that Woodrow Wilson did no wrong. And then I remember once, and I may have told you the story, I was at Choate and went to a leadership conference at Columbia University, and it was all about Woodrow Wilson. Ah, this is marvelous stuff. And then one of the professors said, well, the reason Woodrow Wilson cannot make a mistake is because he was an intellectual. Like, what was that again? Well, he's an intellectual, therefore he doesn't make mistakes. And I kept thinking, the whole train ride home, there's something wrong with that. They had this smug, arrogant attitude that because he was, quote, an intellectual, it stands to reason he's always right. I mean, yes, he was right on the League of Nations, but he never got it. The fruit basket never came to his house. Why? Because he never brought anybody else in. He was arrogant. And as a matter of fact, his administration was arrogant, and they didn't enjoy a lot of success. So Woodrow Wilson went from a hero to a fallen idol, if you will. I would say the one that I really did admire was Adlai Stevenson. I adored him. I really did, 1952 and 1956. He was a Choate graduate, so I obviously had a partisan thing to him. But he was so eloquent. And he had the ability to appeal to the idealism in all of us, which is something we miss today. I mean, we really and truly do. Because idealism kind of represents tomorrow. And I thought more than any person, he was able to rise above the pettiness of today and see tomorrow. And I thought his sense of vision was absolutely remarkable. The older I get and the more reading I do, I'm impressed with Eisenhower. I think he had a tremendous sense of pragmatism. I thought he had a very fine administration now that I look back on it. William Howard Taft, I have a lot of respect for him, particularly the fact that he loved the judicial system much more than the political system. And I've kind of wondered, because I'm writing a piece on Mondale, if Mondale wouldn't have been better served being in the legal system as a chief judge rather than as a political figure. I think he would have been both excellent in both, but I think Mondale, the way he thinks and the way he puts things together, it's always as an attorney. And I think that would have been good for the White House, but also would have been good for the Supreme Court. I think he would have been an excellent chief judge. I like Jake Javits. There's a lot of different people that I liked. In terms of Minnesota, it was Elmer Anderson that brought me into the Republican Party, so I always had a special allegiance for Elmer. And I think in so many respects, he was the quintessential prototype of an excellent public servant. I mean, he really liked public service, and he gave a lot to it. He was very, very poor. He put his sisters through school, and his father died when he was 14 years old, and his father was a railroad conductor in the old trolley system in Chicago, and worked himself up to become very successful in business and certainly in politics. Now, there were an awful lot of good people. We've had a lot of good people.
One of the things that's somewhat unique to governor as a leadership position, so to speak, is that governors often come across these sort of unique problems. They're complex. It's not really, there's not really one right answer or one discipline that solves problems. Sometimes issues come out of nowhere. You explained earlier that some days as governor, yeah, you didn't know what was coming in the door. How does someone in a position of governor that has to deal with these dynamic, complex problems, how do they navigate that kind of complexity?
That's the fun of the job. This is a delight. And then somebody pays you for it, too. No, I thought it was an absolute ball. That's what you want, problem solving. It's a remarkable way to make a living.
Well, what I enjoyed about it was, one, every Monday we had the staff. We had an understanding that around the table we're all equal. And everybody prepared well. I mean, we shouldn't assume that the CEO brings in all the good ideas. No, you good ideas can come from a vast number of sources. And the fact that you get a different set of problems, I think that's part of the joy of the office. I mean, it would be terribly dull if it's the same old problem day after day after day after day. No, I thoroughly enjoyed that. I had no problem at all.
What do you think someone has to have to enjoy that? Are there certain qualities that you think you've seen people do that well? Or
I think it's very helpful to have a root philosophy. My mother would always say, "To thine own self be true," and I think that's the essence of life. I think far too many people stick their bloody finger up in the wind and find out which way the wind is blowing. Well, they don't forget winds change directions. And then who are you? I mean, you've got to decide: are you the change agent, or are you the person who's on the receiving end of somebody else's change? Why go through the pain of running for governor and then give up your right to govern to the wind? Let the wind get his own governorship. So I never understood that. It just doesn't make any sense. I think you got to have a root philosophy, and I think you got to be true to yourself, and you've got to be appreciative of the inputs of a variety of other people, and then figure out what is a good strategy. I mean, ultimately, the people are going to decide. And you're not always going to come up with the right decision. Sometimes you're just going to boot it. That's the way life is. The best thing you can do is acknowledge it, correct it, and go on. But people have a remarkable way. You know, we have these silly polls. They go to people and they say, "Well, what do you think the most important issue is?" They don't know what the most important issue is. "Oh, well, crime." Well, frankly, it may not be. But that's the expected answer. So they come up with it. But when people start to think about it, they come up with a very different answer. Do you think somebody's going to tell you the reason I like Charlie Jones and want him to be our next United States Senator is because I really think in his face and in his actions he reflects character? No. I like his position on Zamba. The way he spoke against those Zambanese, that's my kind of guy. Yes, sirree. Horse manure. No. We're like dogs. We smell. And we basically say, this person has an acceptable smell. That's my kind of person that I want in the White House. Because ultimately what you're saying is, I trust that person. That person is going to be making decisions on concerns that may not exist today. So you look at Obama and you say, now what kind of a president will he be on issues of war and peace? And our answer is something that we kind of smell. What we, and maybe smell is not the appropriate word. I'll probably eradicate that when I go through these transcripts, go to something a little bit more educated.
I like this extended metaphor.
Yeah. But we sense that he is the kind of person who has the ability to reflect. He's not going to make an instant judgment. And he's going to make a decision that I would respect as concerned. So because of his judgment, I'd say yes. My kind of guy. I see that in Mondale. He's not going to make a rash, quick political decision. Because remember, on the Iraq war, polling was overwhelmingly in favor of that war. The New York Times loved the idea of going to war. The London Economist thought it was a brilliant idea. And Tom Friedman wrote a column on how marvelous it would be to see the Middle East have this garden of success that it could copy. They were all wrong. But in any event, to answer your question, it is the totality of the character. Because ultimately, you're giving your being to another person to make a number of decisions that affect your being. And it is about judgment.
So this actually leads to one of the questions that, a little more specific to home here. How might you describe what Minnesotans want in their political leaders? What do you think the Minnesota culture seems to value in terms of character?
Well, I think traditionally it would be prudence. I'm not sure about that anymore. I think we're becoming a difficult state to read. This whole thing with the stadium is a much bigger concern than we may think, because we willingly poured in an endless amount of money that we didn't have to build it. A prudent society doesn't do that. And so I'm a bit uncertain, but in my day, I would say that it was prudent. It's prudent to feed a three-year-old girl. It's prudent to give an education to a child. I'll never forget a very nice letter from my mother, who at that time must have been well in her 70s, and she said, "I hope you have the wisdom," and this is right after I was elected, "I hope you have the wisdom to make the right choice of education for the young or a transplant for people like me." I've never forgotten that. Because there's a great deal of truth in the choice that she's saying. And we're not making that decision today.
So a leader needs to have some support group, followers of sorts. You mentioned that one of the aspects of governorship is interactions with your staff. How might you describe your ways of choosing your staff? How did you go about hiring?
Frankly, the staff was very eclectic. It came from a variety of different sources, but at least we had certain things in common. The first staff was a disaster. The second one was competence, knowledge of the political system, but we were much more specific in what we expected. And it's just hummed like a six-cylinder engine. To my way of thinking, it was flawless.
What kind of boss were you? What was it like working for you
opinion? Obviously you have to ask them. but I hope that everybody felt that they had input into whatever came out. I hope they felt that they were empowered. I hope they went home at night and said, "You know, we just had a wonderful meeting. We decided to do X and blah, 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 and I did this, 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 and this," as opposed to, "Oh, the governor came in and he pounded the table and he said, we're going to do this." I think the Christie style of management is offensive. I think it's non-productive, and I think it's a disaster. And I think his administration is a disaster. And it reflects totally on him, totally on him. That's the bombastic, "I know the truth" style, and let me beat you bloody with my views. You run the risk that you might be wrong. I mean, no higher power came down and said governors are infallible. He may have done it to kings for a while, but not with governors. Boy, you guys catch on quickly, don't you? They don't believe in the divine right of kings. What do I do?
How did you go about appointing officials, especially to the Supreme Court, Kathleen Blatz? And
well, the Supreme Court, no. The court assignments received an enormous amount of diligence. It would start with a process where whoever wants to apply for the district court is welcome to apply. Then it went through a committee. But we were also looking for skill sets. If the current court was weighted too much in one direction, then we looked, and I'm not talking politically, I'm talking in terms of skill sets. So most courts in Minnesota were undernourished on the corporate side, so you didn't have strong business people there. So one of our goals was to get some people with some very strong business. Well, that's very hard to do because in the private sector, they're making a ton of dough. But that is one of our weaknesses. We were packed with public defenders and packed with people who worked on the social side. So, yes, we sought that. We didn't have any kind of a litmus test in terms of abortion or anything else. I would say the system that was created worked out very, very well. On the Supreme Court, we took we did not go through panels. We did that on our own. And by and large, we did the right thing. I'm unhappy with one of my appointments, but other than that, I'm very pleased. Yeah. Kathleen Blatz was largely, well, there were two parts to that. One had to do with a woman by the name of Anne Simonette, and I think I talked to you about it before, who died at age 41. But I had appointed her with the notion that she would eventually be elevated, and Kathleen Blatz would do it too. They were both roughly, I think, the same age at that time. I happen to believe in generational politics, and by that I mean my generation, I think, was good at certain things, but we're not good at some other things. And what Kathleen had done, she had done an awful lot of work in adoption, a lot of work with truancy, a lot of work with children in need, and she was much more up on it than my generation would be. And one of the decisions I had to make was who would be the chief judge. And that decision I made largely on the basis that she was much more in tune with what's coming down the pike than some older people would be. And I had said before that I'm critical of those people who come to office for the goal of just presiding. Usually they're presiding over yesterday. I wanted somebody that could preside over tomorrow. And so Kathleen was absolutely the right choice. And she did turn the court around.
I want to ask sort of a little bit, one little broader question about leadership, which often comes into how governors or people in leadership positions are evaluated. And there's this, I don't want to say tension, but a duality of results and relationships. So on the one hand, you know, getting things, quote, done, you know, achieving some objective is one way they're evaluated, but they're also evaluated in the means in which they go about achieving those and in the relationships that are built. And when I look at some of the results you've had and then the change in relationships over your time in office, it was really interesting. The 1991 sort of more combative to at the end having what appeared to be very positive and productive relationships. And I wanted to get your perspective on, as someone who's been around and leading, that tension of results and relationships, if that makes sense.
No, it makes a lot of sense. I think when people come into office, it's kind of like two dogs meeting for the first time. They smell each other.
A lot of dog metaphors here.
Yeah, well, another one, yeah. But they can also be aggressive towards each other, because they're wary. You got to remember, there's an expectation when you come out of the legislature, well, it stands to reason the governor knows the legislative process and blah, 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 therefore he'll succeed. Nonsense, absolute nonsense. The opposing party is not there for the purpose of seeing you succeed. Quite the opposite. If they can drown you, they will. And so you got to be very, very careful of that. That's why they're called the opposing party. But be that as it may, there are several things that we did not do. We did not engage in any kind of language that was colorful, you know, I want to say colorful, but personal or critical. They have a job to do. We have a job to do. There's certain things you don't do. A man and a wife, you know, if a man says to his wife, you're a rotten mother, that's the end of that marriage. It's over with. There's certain terminology you never, ever engage in. And once you start to get into an administration that wants to call names to those people who oppose you in the legislature, you got to remember tomorrow they're your allies. We had a Democrat legislature. If we want to get anything done, we got to get something through them. So ultimately, they have the final power. I can prevent them from succeeding, but they had the power to prevent me from succeeding too. So you got to respect that. Two, their leadership were talented,
They were honorable. They were good people. And the fact that you're on a different mission doesn't mean that you have to personally dislike them. And so we didn't. We didn't. I can't recall anybody that I personally disliked. Yes, there was one. I won't tell you who it was. But yes, I did have fun. He came late to a governor's gathering, and I closed the gates and forced him to go home.
Be that as it may. No, you respect the office that they represent, and you respect them, and over time you obviously get to like them, and they get to like you. My God, there's nothing sinister, nothing mean. I mean, we're not grabbing money and putting it into our pockets and running home. We're all talking about how do you disperse the public's money, and can you disperse it in such a way that two different people can agree upon? That's what it's about. So I don't recall anything that I would call abusive or anything else. I mean, I think the abusive language is right off the bat. Doug Johnson was pretty tough. But he's a tough character. And that's the way life is. But other than that, I think it went very well. Now, I respected the speakers, and as I indicated at my prior meeting, we never could have gotten health care through if it weren't for that speaker. What was her name? But in any event, she was the one who saved the day. And you owe a lot to the opposite side for getting an awful lot of stuff through. They were always very, very helpful. Very helpful.
So where do you think, or where do you believe you might have fallen short as a leader? Where do you think you could have been a more effective leader?
Well, I mean, I think, one, you're always critical of your own personality. That's one of the hardest things to live with, is your own personality. And at some point, you got to say, you know what? That's just me. I mean, I'm stuck. That's who I am. Yeah, I mean, I wish I had certain talents of other people. I don't have them. That's the way life goes. So you got to make do with what you got. But there's something else. I had a senior moment here. You raise your question again.
Where
do you went wrong? I think on the policy fronts, I do believe that about every 10 years you have to scrape barnacles off the boat. And we should have initiated a program that was started by Governor Wendell Anderson, where you bring in the private sector and you start to evaluate functions, purpose, goals, et cetera. And then are you delivering them in the most cost-effective way? I can't remember what the name of his program was right now. Loaned Executive, LEAP. Loaned Executive program. I thought that was an excellent program. And I think that about every 10 years, government needs that, because government's not in the competition business. So unlike a corporation that's always got to scrape barnacles in order to stay competitive, we don't. And you see that a lot in the current administration. There's just no reform. It's just more money piled on top of more money on top of more money. And it's not going to work. It just will not work. So I do have a regret not doing that. And I would have liked to have had another year or two with UDOF at the university. I think because our dream was to get the bridge built over the river and have the student union really face that river, and then build over Washington Avenue so the lawn and the mall would be contiguous, not interrupted by the road. And I wanted to put more money into the med school. We put as much as we could into the med school. I wish that we had literally forced them to take more, because the med school, particularly in Minnesota, it's got to be the flagship. I mean, right now it's ranked 30th. I don't know if it's ranked 30th on the basis of elements that may or may not have value. I don't know, but it's a concerning item, and I wish we had the ability or commitment, whatever, to really focus on the med school and get that, because we were strong in engineering. I think it's fair to say we were strong in every area. I think we could have been stronger in the computer sciences, and I think we had to be stronger in the healthcare area.
So sort of switching to some pretty broad questions to close our discussion a little bit here, is what do you think your most lasting legacy has been from being governor? Like, what do you think that in your time of office, what's sort of your legacy? What are you known for?
I suspect that the popular interpretation will be in the area of finance, long-term planning, getting the AAA bond rating back, and the areas of financial discipline. But the truth is, we don't get the luxury of defining our own legacy. I think that's we think we do, but we don't. One, history will do it for us. But two, the public has already decided. They've long decided. I mean, I don't care what you do with me now, unless it's a Bill Cosby moment, my legacy's not going to change. Because they've already fixed what it is. And parts of it I'll like, and parts of it I may not like. So what I think is really not all that relevant. What I hope comes out is that we try to balance tomorrow's agenda with the realities of today. And by that I mean merging and creating the Department of Family, Children, and Learning, which I think is an amalgamation. Because I had referred before to John Brandel, who's back there, talking about the health exam, and why is it we look at the feet and not the head? Why don't we do the total body? And I thought that approach of bringing all these departments together to focus on the well-being of the child, that was it. And from that could have sprung and should have sprung a vast number of reforms. I mean, one was we funded and tried to succeed in building some boarding schools. Well, that's a very foreign concept in Minnesota. But the truth is, not every child lives in a warm, welcoming family. And those children need access. And the best way to do it is to get them out of their families. There's nothing wonderful about a little boy coming home to be beaten within an inch of his life by his father. That's not a healthy relationship. But that is a reality for many of these children. And they run away, and they seek help. And what do? We say, oh, no, you belong back with your parents. Boy, that's healthy. The kid shows some intelligence, some gumptions, and gets out of a bad situation. We should reward him. And so we wanted boarding schools where you could go, similar to Hershey, Pennsylvania, and get room and board and education. And I think ultimately that's going to be a lot cheaper than paying the price of failure. We have a hard time in our society understanding the enormous cost of failure. And the sad part is we're willing to fund it. We're willing to put as much money into failure as we possibly can come up with. Seriously, more prisons? You bet. Get those failures out of here. We'll pay anything to get the failures out of here. To go to the Hennepin County School in my day cost $40,000 a year. At that time, Harvard was barely $30,000. But we're willing to spend 40 if we can just get them out of here. Why not invest less money up front and allow them to succeed? What bothers me about the American debate today is that there's this notion that I got where I am because of me. Boy, am I wonderful. What nonsense. The truth is, I don't think there's a single successful person in this planet who didn't have that success because some hand reached down and gave you some opportunity. But we don't want to recognize that because that involves a compact with broader society, and we don't want to acknowledge that broader society played a role in personal success. But it did. And it may be a small episode. But if you were to ask people, name some times when the invisible hand came down, they will. I remember being very bashful, and I always came home with wet pants. Well, to a lot of people, that's funny. But to the little boy, that's not so funny. What was the reason? Because I was so bashful, I didn't want to raise my hand and ask permission to go to the bathroom. So Mrs. Weed, I'll never forget, met with my mother and said, I'll appoint him monitor. That way he can leave without having to raise his hand. Now, here I am 70 years later, and I remember Mrs. Weed. That was an invisible hand. It was a small episode, but it was important. At that point, it was very important. And there are a whole series of those. I mean, I can point to Choate, and that was the big hand coming down. But there were a whole series of small hands. Go in for a job interview. And somebody says, you know, you don't quite have the background that I want. You don't quite have the resume that I'm looking for. But I got a gut feeling. And he bet on you. Bingo. You succeeded. So I would like to see us go back to being a society where we understand that we're all related to each other.
So we wanted to ask a question that actually we were talking about before we started recording here, and we're not going to ask you specifically about golf and fishing. However,
you've stayed quite active in discussions of policy issues since leaving office. Describe the types of issues that can keep you engaged, and where do you kind of hope to go from
here?
Well,
you know, you've got some choices. You know, they send you out to this thing called retirement. What the heck does it mean? Nobody defines it. Nobody even writes about it. But I've seen far too many people get into an active life of golf, and they sit around a lunch table and they argue about golf, and they go to dinner and they argue about golf. Who the hell? I don't give a darn about golf. There's more to life than worrying about your scores on a golf course. And some people find that joyful. I don't. Catching a fish, I mean, I don't know. The fish doesn't seem to enjoy it. I don't get a big kick out of it. So why do it? So what is it that you want to do? And I've always loved governance or issues of politics, whatever you want to call it. And I intend to go to my grave loving it and writing about it.
Why did you retire anyway? I mean,
I happen to believe that you got your 8 years in, and that's enough. After that, things start to get a little mucky. Your administration starts to believe that you're kind of immune from any kinds of problems, and people get sticky fingers, and all sorts of terrible things happen. So I'm not an advocate of a third term. Two, the people get bored with you. They want a new face. I mean, let's be honest. They're not going to say it, but they want a new face. And thirdly, they take your assets for granted, and they start to focus more on your blemishes, and probably with a lot of truth. Besides, I don't want to be a Chris Christie. What a joke. But in any event, no. So I like it. I like what I do. I love writing blogs. I'm a fairly decent writer, so why not write about things? I like history, so I'd like to write historical blogs. And then once in a while, I get involved in a good old tussle. Voter ID turned me on. I loved it.
What drew you to that?
Pardon me?
What might have drawn you into that?
You know, I'm not sure.
We're known, Minnesota is known as having some of the, you know, most, I think, fair, better elections, especially with same-day voter registration and things like that.
Yeah, but you got a whole group of these new Republicans that want to abolish everything and reserve the right to vote to themselves and a few of their select friends, and that's it. Well, that was a creaky way to end it.
Got that on the mic, Sam? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There used to be a show called The Inner Sanctum. Oh, my God, you got a picture of Mondale up here. That's not the best picture of him, by the way.
So this actually leads to an interesting question that you're alluding to, and that we've talked about a little bit in our previous discussions, is that politically you've had sort of an interesting career, starting, you know, very much in the Democratic camp, and then and moving, and then receiving some criticism from Republicans, and back and forth. And you've also been very, you know, vocal about, you know, both parties. So you've seen the Democratic and Republican parties change a lot since your time as governor. You know, what do you think has changed, and what do you think might be happening going forward?
Well, I've come to the conclusion that I'm nothing but a bloody independent, and probably always have been. And it's not likely I'm going to change. But, you know, then again, I say to myself, why should I give my independence to somebody else so I can be, quote, a member of the club? And so I don't. And I think that's the way a good number of Americans are starting to move, infinitely more independent than they were before, particularly as the Republican Party moves not just to the far right, but to the radical right. It's not a conservative party. That's a myth that the media has created. It's not a conserving party. It is a radical party. And it should be described in those terms. And I'm not trying to be overly critical, but they no longer identify with the same history of the Republican Party that I do. They don't go back. You don't hear them talking about Abraham Lincoln. You don't hear them talking about Theodore Roosevelt. Everything begins and starts with their version of Ronald Reagan. But it's their version. It's not the version of history. Reagan increased taxes 11 times, and that's not the Reagan they talk about. Reagan appointed a pro-choice woman to the Supreme Court. That's not the Reagan they talk about. They talk about their caricature and their interpretation of Reagan, which was largely based on rhetoric and not performance, because government grew under Reagan. It didn't shrink.
Do you have concerns about the parties in Minnesota and sort of their current state of affairs? Or?
Well, after last session, no. One guy beat the daylights out of the other two. Wow. And I see this media is giving it a very unique interpretation. This was not a battle this last session of Republicans versus Democrat. This was a battle of Democrat versus Republican. And you haven't read anything about that, have you? Every bad bill that the governor disliked passed the Democrat Senate. Now, what does that say? You basically had a session where the governor did not manage his portfolio. And two, invited, if you will, the results that he ultimately got. And then finally lost just about everything in the closing hours. Not a very good session. Not a very good session at all. And the price that we're going to pay is going to be on the water quality issue. We lost the PCA governing board, which is an incredibly important instrument in terms of the environment. And we have an administration that's playing a little footsie with PolyMet. Now think about it. The best natural resource that we have in this state is water, by far the best. And for 300 jobs, many of which are temporary, we are willing to run the risk of damaging those waters forever. That is about as dumb a deal as you could get. That's the only thing that is dumber than that downtown. And that is really dumb.
I wanted to also offer you the opportunity. We want to sort of do a little bit of wrap up here, but offer you the opportunity if you wanted to come back and talk more about, you know, current issues, we'd be glad to do that if you want to get on the record.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't mind that at all. And I'm very upset with this water thing. I'm serious.
Sure. But to sort of end this, if this part of it, if we could, if we wanted to again offer, as we did last time, if there's anything you wish we had discussed.
If I may, I would suggest two things. One is, sure, I would do the campaign.
Okay.
Because it is unique in American history. I only saw a slice of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are a bagload of other people that you should talk to.
Sure.
And in terms of my views on the future, I'd be happy to give them. But what I am concerned about is there is virtually no discussion in Minnesota today about tomorrow. And when you go back over the years, every single year we've always discussed tomorrow. We're not discussing tomorrow anymore. We're not really using the phrase quality of life very much anymore. That's kind of faded away. And that tells me that we're not defining our own future. We're extremely weak on reform. We're not discussing reforms. Why not? We are managing yesterday's status quo. That's all we're doing. And yesterday's status quo is not going to carry us to tomorrow. That's the indictment of what we have currently. I mean, that's one of the nice things about Obama is he's always bubbling about tomorrow. You know, I got a new item, so the press said, oh, it's a legacy item. Screw the legacy. The point is he wants to focus the discussion on something else. That's what you need. People want to move toward tomorrow, and they expect political leadership to paint a picture of what that tomorrow could look like, and prayerfully is better than today. I don't see that in Minnesota. And the more we continue to protect yesterday's status quo, the more we're going to continue to slip. So we're practicing avoidance. And the Democrats have a long way to go. They better face up to their division, and they better face up to it very sharply. Because it's a healthy division. If the party decides to go the way of the North and pollute Lake Superior, they will be extinct for many, many years. And it's time for that metropolitan liberal to start taking ownership and speaking out instead of cowering under. But right now, I don't see that kind of leadership emerging. I just don't see it.
I mean, do you want to weigh in on anything else? Or?
I think
I'm set. Yeah. So, I mean, if there's anything you think we've missed in our questioning or that you would like to talk more about, we can do that.
I bet you just love it.
You're an enabler.
Another hour with that dreadful governor. That's awful. Bring in Jesse. At least he's refreshing. No, I don't know. I don't know what more I could add or delete or anything else.
Sure. Well, as we mentioned, too, we're going to give you the opportunity to look over the transcript and make sure it's...
Yeah, I probably use some language I shouldn't. That always gets me into trouble. No, I think we're in fine shape.
Great. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming back.
No, delighted. Thank you.
Talking with for even longer this time, so it was great.
That's what happens when you're retired.
Was it longer, though?
We got some fishing on the record there.
Yeah, I'm a terrible fisherman. The irony is my brother was a damn good one, the older one. God, he loved it. But not me. Why are you looking so serious?
I'm amazed that you sat here as long as you did. Was it an ordeal for you?
Or no, not at all. You know, Powell was raised about 15 blocks from where I was in the Bronx. Mm. He was down by the water, too. But that's an amazing story of success. And that truly is. Yeah. Coming out of CCNY and ultimately becoming a general, I mean, that's phenomenal. Truly phenomenal. He would have made a very good president. But that's another one that the Republicans drove out of the ranch.
We also wanted to offer as well, if you wanted to grab lunch with us or if you have time. I'm not sure what you're...
No, I'd be delighted. Where are you going?
Just in the basement here is the best University of Minnesota restaurant.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think
it's bistro. It's great.
Let's go to the basement. Yeah.
Thanks again.
You bet.
Yeah, thank you guys so much.
Yeah, I was just going to point out three things before you...
All right.
No,
sure. Let's sit back down.
What should be on the Minnesota agenda... The impact of global warming. We're seeing it right now in our lakes, and it's going to continue to affect our quality of life in a very, very negative way. And we can't just pretend that yesterday will take care of it. It won't. I don't have a clue what the answer is, but the point is that's an agenda item that should be openly discussed. The impact of technology. Are we where we ought to be in terms of our technological development, and does our K-12 system and our higher ed system reflect those changes in technology? I have a deep suspicion the answer is no. And that means that enormous amount of efforts are going to have to be made to properly equip every single child in K-12 with the electronic equipment that's necessary. The problem with older people governing is that they tend to see things in the context of their generation. In my generation, if you came out of a defective school system, you could still make it up because it was largely based on your capacity to read and speed read, if you will. Today is technology. You can't make it up. That's the problem.
So if a kid isn't where he ought to be when he's 8 years old, we're going to lose him. And we are going into the next era, which I don't know if we necessarily have to plan for it or not, but it's robotic. And the impact of robots on the world economy is going to be unbelievable. You're going to have massive, massive problems of unemployment and dislocation. Now, how you plan for it, I don't know. But the likelihood that that becomes the norm could very well be the case. And that means you start to put other issues on the table. You may not be able to afford the luxury of a 40-hour work week. You may have to be discussing a 25-hour work week in order to spread more work around more people. In other words, turning the element of somebody else producing than a human being, turning that into an asset, not a liability. And right now, we're still working under archaic systems, an archaic tax system that was basically a 19th century notion, and an education system that hasn't literally changed in over 100 years. And what an oddity that the very people who profess change are the ones who are most resistant to it. So all of that has to be on. And the third piece that I put down here was global competition. It's something that we verbalize, but we don't understand it. The honest truth is, if we can't get the talent here on a corporate level, we'll get it elsewhere. And you know what? That's exactly what's happening. And that means that way too many Americans will be passed over. Because corporations, by their very definition, are international, and they have no loyalty to one nation. They're loyal to themselves. And when you invest in a company, you invest to maximize your profit and your financial gain. You don't maximize it based, or you don't make the investment based on the fact that they wave an American flag or a Dutch flag. And I just don't see this as part of our state agenda. And it should be. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
That's fabulous.